Ok, parfait.
There's a saying, shoot for the stars and you might hit the moon. Not so bad. You can change the world as long as you don't care who gets credit. So the idea is not to never fail, it's to fail a million times a day. Even if you're exceptionally creative, a key component is listening to other people. What's nice is if you combine the experience of an adult, even a senior adult, with the attitude of a child, that's far better than either one of them separately. You could do what Yogi Berra said, which is when you come to a fork in the road, you take it.
Welcome to the Night Science Podcast,
where we explore the untold story of the scientific creative process.
We are your hosts.
I'm Itai Yanai.
And I am Martin Lurcher.
George Church is a professor of genetics at the Harvard Medical School, where he also leads a large research group at the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, where he was also a founding member. George is known for pioneering the fields of personal genomics and synthetic biology.
George has co-founded around 50 biotech companies, and in 2018 alone, his lab spun off 16 startups. In 2017, Time magazine listed him among the 100 most influential people in the world. And he was also listed among the top 8 most famous geneticists in human history. And so, George, welcome. It's a great honor for us to have you here.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Wonderful. So, you know, George, the projects that you work on, they seem almighty at times. Do you think that part of your creative process is thinking in big science fiction-like way of imagining things that could become real?
Certainly the science fiction part, definitely.
And is your thinking, when you have a big science fiction-like goal, that you may not achieve it, at least not right away, but that at least it sort of sets the direction?
Yeah, there's a saying, you know, shoot for the stars and you might hit the moon. Not so bad. You know, I think what it does by embracing big ideas, I'm not comfortable with just saying something big and leaving it that. The way that science fiction authors can and should practice their art, they can just say, and then we had a warp drive, and then no details.
Right, right. The flux capacitor.
All sorts of things that defy physics. I prefer to put down some little breadcrumbs along the future path, kind of connect the dots as well as we can before we articulate the first vision publicly. And it does help bring people into the fold. It also helps people start thinking about ways that could go wrong and they can warn us.
It sounds fascinating when you talk about putting down the breadcrumbs. What exactly are you doing there?
Well, so for example, at the beginning of the Genome Project, people were willing to accept that we were going to spend $3 billion for one genome, but I felt that that was completely unacceptable because we wanted to do everybody on the planet. At least that's what I had been wanting to do since I was a graduate student. And that wasn't going to happen at $3 billion times, you know, I guess back then it was 6 billion people. And so I could have just said, oh, we're going to make a little device that fits in the palm of your hand and sequences everybody. That would work in science fiction. But instead I said, okay, I'm inspired by the Coulter counter, which measures, you know, sizes of particles. And I'm inspired by patch clamp, which measures single molecules in neurons. And I'm inspired by atomic force microscopy or standing tunneling microscopy, which is kind of taking pictures of almost single molecule resolution of DNA at the time. This is around 1985-ish. And I said, we're going to put those together. So those are some of the breadcrumbs. We put them together, and we're going to call it nanopore sequencing. And that was considered absolutely insane at the time, even though I gave three precedents for single molecule or single particle measurements. Three, not one. But some people were inspired by it. Most people thought it was funny. But the thing that's important in the creative process, or at least in our version of it and in my lab, is to not immediately reject things as impossible. You don't have to say they're going to happen tomorrow, but you don't have to say they're impossible either. So instead of throwing it in the waste bin, we put it up on the wall as this is something we haven't figured out how to do quite yet, but we're going to.
Right. in a sense, any new idea will strike us as impossible. You know, Steve Jobs said that creativity is connecting things. So that seems to be like these breadcrumbs. But I guess there's a certain genius to knowing what to connect, right? Anything could be connected to anything.
Right.
How do you have the intuition for what might go together with what?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously a random number generator could connect any pair of ideas in the world. And I don't know what fraction of those would be useless. So how do you do it? It requires an exceptional level of curiosity. It helps to have at least one person on the team, and ideally almost everybody on the team, be multidisciplinary. I've seen deans and presidents try building multidisciplinary teams from the top disciplinarians, and it's like oil and water. You put a pot of money in the middle of the table, and they all come and they take it and they run centrifugally outwards as fast as they can. But if you take a bunch of people that already know, let's say, two subjects, two very different subjects in detail, that means they're bilingual, basically. And even if they don't share a language, you've got four languages on the table, and they'll either learn a fifth one or they'll share one of the four. And that makes it easy to stitch together a team. But it also helps to have somebody who's interested in literally everything. And that's kind of where I come in. I had ADHD big time when I was young, and dyslexia and narcolepsy. And so you could say I didn't think too clearly. But eventually develop coping mechanisms and try to turn lemon into lemonade. And so I'm very curious about many different things, and that helps me integrate teams that can carry them out. The specific example of how you pick combinations is if you ask, what are all the things that can detect single molecules, right? You make a list of them. That's a short list, and they actually make some sense. You haven't picked two random things like Serbo-Croatian and refrigerator condensers and say, does that go together? Maybe it does, but anyway, not for technology development for DNA sequencing.
Yeah. You know, I'm really intrigued by what you were saying about these things that you had when you were young, ADHS, dyslexia, and narcolepsy, and that you turned lemon into lemonade, suggesting that part of your creativity comes from how your brain functions, maybe in different ways from the brains of many other people.
That is a narrative that one hears. I'm not exactly saying, I'm saying more like almost any difference from everybody else can be leveraged. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have a specific advantage. Your advantage is that you don't fit in. And if you don't fit in, well, first of all, you get more time to yourself because you don't have any friends. But you also just accept the fact that you're different. And so you don't try to be the same. And so then you go and you look around for other differences. And this can be obesity, it can be acne, it can be all the things that young kids discriminate based on. And you can't pass any laws to prevent that discrimination. You can't easily do it. Now, there may be some specific advantages too. I like the fact that I fall asleep and wake up refreshed in a few seconds or minutes. And sometimes I come up with weird ideas as a consequence too. But the main thing is I just don't ignore them, right? It's so easy to just say, this is a distraction.
Yeah, I experience it a lot myself too, that when you finally have an idea, for me, it takes so long, but if I finally have an idea, other people will say, yeah, I thought about that too. But they didn't act on it. We're all sort of experiencing the same world of ideas. The ideas are sort of in the air. The differential might just be who acts on them and who just ignores them.
Well, also there's the perception there's kind of a zero-sum game, that you're only going to be able to act on one or two ideas in your lifetime. And so you better pick them very carefully. My experience was that you can work on a whole bunch of them. You can change the world as long as you don't care who gets credit. So if you're willing to just do things partially and then let somebody else get the credit, you can do a lot more. And so I kind of got used to that notion as well.
Right. I mean, it seems as though there's an attitude of committing fast and also not giving up fast. Maybe we live in this culture where you have to think very carefully and make very judicious decisions on what to do. But really, if you just commit to many ideas all at once, it's sort of like playing the lottery of ideas that one of them could turn up.
Yeah, it still helps to be playing a game of skill rather than a game of luck. I think you really hit the nail on the head, which is not worrying too much about the risk. Now, there's some places where you have to worry about the risk, you know, when you're dealing with human lives, for example. NASA has a motto that failure is not an option. And that's because you have very high profile deaths possible. But right. We don't worry about human deaths when we start invading countries, but that's a different matter. So in our case, the metaphor that I like, rather than three astronauts in a can, is libraries. In fact, libraries of chemical compounds and libraries of nucleic acids and cells. And these libraries are things where we can make billions of objects that have been designed, not just random objects, and then we can run them through a selection, and then we can pick the winners. And from that standpoint, we've had millions of losers. So the idea is not to never fail, it's to fail a million times a day. In fact, Edison said something kind of like this. He wasn't quite so proud about the one filament that worked in the light bulb, but the 999 that didn't. You know, that showed the real empirical approach. And we live in an era where you really can test billions of different designed objects. That's not typically the way you build bridges, but it is the way you do molecular biology.
So you're saying that with those libraries, we can actually look at millions of chemical compounds and see which ones work and which ones don't work. But how do you use it as a metaphor for your general process?
Right. So the metaphor is accepting micro failures, not rejecting ideas because you think it's going to take an enormous amount of time. Instead, reframing it so it doesn't take an enormous amount of time. And even after they're rejected from selection number one, you still put them up on the wall and you can use them later for selection number two or project number two. So it's reframing it from, we're going to get this right first time. It's going to be hard. We're going to think about it a long time. We're not going to take any risks. We're going to do it as fast as possible. We're going to hold it together with duct tape and rubber bands if necessary. Yeah. We can also use excellent engineering tools as well. But the point is, we're going to do a lot of stuff. And even the stuff that doesn't work might inspire us. It has a higher chance of serendipity. So it's just embracing the diversity.
And you know what's so interesting about this, George, is that it seems as though there's two kinds of engineering. There's the engineering where you need the astronauts to be safe. Failure is not an option. But then there's the kind of engineering that is creative. You don't mind things failing. It's a different kind of engineering because you're exploring.
Yeah, I would say we need hypothesis generation, and we have some of that historically, but there is a new kind of engineering where you're embracing things with a much higher failure rate. One of the breakthroughs, as I understand it, the early days of Google was constructing a big disk farm out of lots of disks that had higher failure rate than the best in the industry. They instead had algorithms that would basically do error tolerance. So here we have not only error tolerance, but error embracing as you're using it as inspiration. And I should point out that safety is one of our top goals, but it doesn't mean that while we're doing the first experiments, failure is not an option. It just means that failure is not an option once we deliver it to routine public practice.
Yeah. Wow, George, I love that analogy you just made to the disks. The logic there is that you don't need a never failing disk. You just need an algorithm that does error correction. And maybe that analogy extends also to your team, that when you have people working on projects, you may not want just like one genius doing everything. That's not how you really get things done, but more of many people working together and perhaps covering up each other's flaws because they can achieve something better together in some way?
Absolutely. I mean, it's good to have a social fabric where people are not jealous of other people's successes, where people are not stigmatizing failures, where people who take a chance on a bigger project get included as authors, even if their part of it fails. You need to say, look, we know we're going to need some failures. Some people are going to fail at everything they do, not because they're incompetent, but because luck of the draw. And so let's include them. So that's part of the culture. And then also is to kind of encourage them to think out of the box. Rather than stigmatizing failure, you say, okay, as soon as you get an idea, we can write a grant about it. We know that grants probably can get rejected. So what we're going to do is before they even judge us, we're going to fund it from internal funds. That helps to have internal funds. You know, a lot of this is a bit of a chicken and egg thing. But once you get a little royalty income and maybe a little philanthropy that's unrestricted, then you can fund these things as soon as the idea is written down. And then they get the kind of the instant feedback that, oh yeah, I'm being rewarded for the idea. And then they start getting enough preliminary data so that when the grant is rejected, they can just put it in again now with more data and hopefully the second time you get it.
So George, you mentioned several things that play a role for the creative process in your group or for your own creative process. You know, you talked about putting people together that speak different languages, know different things, about not ignoring ideas, not saying things are impossible, embracing errors and using them as inspiration. So it seems that you have a very large portfolio of tricks or of habits that make your group maybe more creative than many other scientific groups. What do you think is the biggest secret to that creativity?
Well, I'm not making any claims about my own creativity, but I would say that even if you're exceptionally creative, a key component is listening to other people. I think there's a tendency for like the Hollywood geniuses to be arrogant and not listen to other people. At minimum, they're not informed. They might be just as smart as the hero or the anti-hero, but they're not informed. But listening to the uninformed is actually quite valuable. If you listen to the societal requests, you get inspiration for what you should be working on, but it doesn't tell you how you would do it. So, for example, you know, we like communicating with artists and screenwriters and journalists because they'll ask you questions like, well, okay, we're using your next-gen sequencing to sequence ancient DNA. Could you bring it back? In Jurassic Park, they
and there's the idea.
And why not listen to them, right? And ask, why can't we bring them back, you know? With an RFK that said, some people ask why, and I ask why not. But why not tells you where the little brick balls are that you're going to jump over or go around or break.
So it's interesting to think that when you're listening to other people and you're spawning these ideas of saying, well, why not? Why can't you bring the woolly mammoth back? Is there associated with that a kind of childlike attitude, you know, what some other people might call immature?
You know, I talk to a lot of people who are pretty old children, you know, like teenagers and graduate students, and they'll have a truly half-baked, quarter-baked idea. And what's nice is if you combine the experience of an adult, even a senior adult, with the attitude of a child, that's far better than either one of them separately. And that's what you're kind of looking for. I think you really need both in the same brain, very comfortable with each other.
Right. And it's interesting to imagine that you're talking to people who are young in their 20s. And as the saying goes, you keep getting older and they stay the same age.
Yes.
So do you feel that there's a widening gap between you and the youngest members, or does it keep you young?
I think it does keep me young. I feel like one, you know, when I'm not looking in the mirror or in the Zoom screen, you know, I still think of myself as a graduate student. That's how I feel. I just can't break the habit of being a scientist. But the gap is being bridged, really, rather than increasing. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is when I started out, I was basically the same age as my postdocs. And I think they very reasonably felt that my ideas were very poor ideas. Nanopore, forget about it. You know, sequencing everybody on the planet, no way. Homologous recombination on thousands of places at once in the genome, forget it. This is 1986, and those were reasonable assessments. But as time went by, and we did some things that people had classified as impossible or useless or both, typically. And anyway, if you do one of those, you could be lucky. Do a couple of them, then it's worth the postdoc's time to listen a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And you do three of them, and then suddenly listen to everything you say. And so the gap is smaller. You've got a conversation going rather than just dismissal. And that was truly invaluable.
You said something very interesting. You said that if you're not reminded of your actual age, you feel like a graduate student. That's how you are a scientist. What's different between being a scientist like a graduate student and like a professor?
Well, the two aspects of professor, three, all right. There's research, there's teaching, and there's administration. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten to the point where teaching is actually fairly easy. I'm not saying I'm the best teacher, but I teach four courses a year. But it doesn't take a lot of time. Administration, I've been allowed to hire a bunch of administrators, and so I'm left with research. And so the graduate student part is, you know, I have a lab at home as well as in the lab, and I do things that are really pointless, but they're experiments. And they keep me thinking like a bench scientist, and I do computing. And so I keep thinking the way I did when I was young, working with primitive computers. And that just helps. It doesn't accomplish that much. I mean, I've earned my way onto a couple of papers by either my bench or my computer skills in the last few years. But mostly it's just, it kind of keeps me thinking that I'm a graduate student. It's more of a self-delusion thing.
Well, self-delusion can be a powerful thing. The problem, though, is wouldn't you say that by now, as you say, you've proved yourself so many times and now people do listen to you. Doesn't that itself come with a lot of danger? Because obviously you do want to be challenged. You do want to have your ideas go through the ringer and have a true collaboration.
You got it right at the beginning there. You said they listen to me, but they're not doing what I say. And that's good. I encourage them to question everybody. A lot of times when an experiment fails, the student blames themselves. And I say, no. It's just as likely that the company that provided you with reagents failed, or the protocol, or the paper you read was wrong or inapplicable. So I tell them, don't trust anyone or anybody, including me. But the fact is they're listening, and we can have a conversation because they're not immediately dismissing everything. And that's a hard habit to form. So it helps to have a little track record to help them. They should be listening to everybody, but not trusting anybody. And what happens is the opposite, is they trust a lot of people, but they don't listen to.
I just want to ask you about, so how do you maintain this culture where the people do listen to you, but then feel free to do whatever they want?
Well, part of that comes automatically from a culture that doesn't stigmatize failure, that just tries not to stigmatize in general. And also it's kind of a fun game, which is to find the flaw, right? And so I'll propose something that's ridiculous. And it's like, what's wrong with this picture you used to do in Highlights magazine? You know, what's wrong with this picture? And I play that game. And we play a lot of brainstorming games. Whenever we do it, if we don't plan it, we'll realize that we're doing it and we'll say, oh, this is great. You know, this is really a lot of fun. Let's keep doing this for a while. So it's like kind of a game playing rather than I'm the professor and I'm going to write a letter for you someday. No, we're playing this game together and we're equals. And the other thing is just try to have a very flat ecosystem where really the professor can go to the bench and do a PCR and the student can write a grant and it's flat. There's no professor, postdoc, graduate student, you know, hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That helps the conversation as well.
So I really like your concept of brainstorming games. Are there other games like that you play in your creative process?
Well, part of it is like, can we collect together potentially relevant articles that don't seem relevant, but if you can pull them in and say, oh yeah, there is a connection here, and then that leads to the other game. So the one game is, what can we bring into the conversation? The other one is, now, what's wrong with the picture? There's probably a bunch of them. We don't usually call them games, but they feel like it.
You know, if you think there's a bunch more of them, I'd be very curious to learn about them.
Well, another one is, I'm a very visual person. So the visual is another set of games you can play, which is, let's draw a picture of how it would be in the future. So let's say, what would the device, we know what society would like to have. How do we walk our way backwards from that by drawing pictures of it? It's like in a dream, you know, you want to see something you really want, and then you're kind of frustrated, you can't see it more clearly. But when you're out of the dream, you can then start filling in the details. So it's like visualizing the future.
We take a quick break from our discussion with George to thank our sponsor. Night Science is supported in part by Research Theory, a nonprofit working to improve creativity and culture in science. Find out more at researchtheory.org.
Research Theory believes that creativity drives good science. And that, of course, is a notion that we relate to very much.
All right. You also said earlier that when the team is perhaps visualizing the dream, that you will include people on the paper that results from it, even though their part didn't actually succeed, but because they were part of the team. And so I think that makes this point that there's a difference between the ideas and the team. The idea has a life of its own. For example, let's say you start out in visualizing the dream in one way, but then the project changed. We saw something, it was unexpected, but now we have to embrace this new direction. Do you experience that sometimes there are the folks that get it, that, okay, this is our reward actually to make this turn, and some that are a little bit resistant and maybe hold the project back a little bit?
Yes and no. I mean, it's important to both be able to pivot, but it's also important to not pivot too often and too radically. You get whiplash.
So, chaotic.
So you need a carefully balanced mixture, and you only get that from having kind of experience, or having somebody on the team who has experience with the right balance. And you can do both at once. You can have part of the team continue the old way and part of the team, it's like a controlled experiment. And part of that comes up when, for example, if you write your grants, you write your mission statement as, we're going to produce 1 billion base pairs in 4 years, then your whole thing is about production and you don't want to throw a monkey wrench into the production line. But if you say our goal is to come up with bunches of ways that somebody can do 1 billion base pairs in much less than the grant period, then that's a different attitude. Same goal, but different attitude. And that's what happened in the Genome Project, is we helped initiate it in 1984, but we tried to get things good enough they could get into commercial sector, and then companies are really good at turning the crank and scaling up and all that stuff. We didn't want to reinvent that wheel. We wanted to just give them better and better resources. And so that's why we developed next-gen sequencing and other nanopore sequencing and a lot of other things. It was to enable without competing with the companies that could turn the crank.
Yeah, you know, what you said about not pivoting too much because I could give you whiplash, that's actually something that Martin and I think about a lot, that with the experience comes the ability to know how also not make the opposite mistake of going too slow, right? Which I guess is the point I tried to make earlier, that an opportunity would come and you don't go for it. And so would you say that over time you've become a good shepherd of projects? You know, you have these young and curious people in your lab that you talk to, and if you avoid looking in the mirror, you may believe you're one of them. And you know how to sort of guide them where it's not like they're changing projects every day, but also not resisting opportunities.
Yeah, I think they have to feel like they're going to get a paper. That's one of the things that motivates and by which people are judged. And to some extent, at least at the lab level, at my level, you could do what Yogi Berra said, which is when you come to a fork in the road, you take it. But at the individual level, you have to protect them. And that means that they can have two projects. In fact, I typically encourage them to have two projects. One is their dream project, which is crazy and everybody's saying is impossible and useless. And then another project, which isn't safe because you picked something mediocre. It's safe because somebody else took an impossible, useless project years before and slowly worked it forward to now it's ready to publish, but there's a whole bunch of stuff to do at that last minute, and you can join in on that and you can get your paper for sure. But neither project was ever mediocre. They were both shooting for the stars. And then back to the wisdom of how to pick and how to nudge. And you actually don't want to feel like you have to claim credit for everything. That's important, like I said earlier. You can change the world if you don't care who gets credit. In particular, you want your students to feel like they came up with it. And they did. And just give them a little bit more credit than they deserve. If that's your attitude, right, you'll have a much better team. And then the other final aspect is there's this notion that if you do anything 10,000 hours, you know, like if you fly a plane for 10,000 hours, you become pretty close to world class. And 10,000 hours isn't that long, really. And the same thing goes for if you all day long look for out-of-the-box solutions to technological problems, which is not something that everybody does. In fact, it's a fairly rare avocation. That's what you do. You'll get good at it. So in this particular case, we choose to do something weird, which is to try to find the low-hanging fruit nobody else can really see the tree, or buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, but it takes 10,000 hours to learn how to find the things that are undervalued.
What would you say are the topics on which you've spent 10,000 hours?
Well, we've talked about a few of them. It's really having deep curiosity in all sorts of extreme values. It's like applying the Guinness Book of World Records to science. You know, it's like just collecting stuff that's out on the fringes of the biggest genome or the smallest genome, or a device that can measure single molecules, not just multi-molecules, just all kinds of idiosyncratic things. So you collect those, which most people figure that's clutter. What I want to know is, what's the best way to sequence DNA today? And who's got the best price? And how can I get the biggest grant to get more of those things into my lab? And I'm out there saying, well, what about patch clamps? And you just collect them and you have a big collection and you keep going through your collection. You know, you don't just put it there out of sight, out of mind. You keep kind of going through it and say, does this thing really have something new to say about this other thing? And again, putting bad ideas or ideas that aren't ready yet, they're not bad, putting them on the wall rather than in the trash or in the vault. So I would say that the main thing that I've spent a lot of time on is at physics and chemistry and weird biology, developmental biology and 3D printing and just collecting things that seem unusual. It's more about embracing the outliers rather than rejecting them.
Putting things up on the wall is something that you mentioned earlier. I'm wondering how I should imagine that. So is that a wall in your brain?
Yeah, it's not on the wall and it's not just in my brain. I think it's important to share it as broadly as possible. It used to be popular to put your ideas in encrypted form. And this is like, I think Newton did this so that you could later take credit for something without revealing it. Well, we don't do that too much anyway. We publish stuff that the world's not ready for, and that's the wall. So for example, when I take notes on things, I often take them in Wikipedia. That is to say, I literally change the Wikipedia page, adding true references, but I'm making connections. They don't really want you doing original research, but as long as you're quoting secondary sources and so forth, you can make the Wikipedia page do new things. That's one way we share it. The other way is we just write peer-reviewed papers. So a lot of it is burying the ideas in a paper, not to obfuscate it, but to make it possible to publish it.
Yeah, I think a lot of young people, I remember I really had this feeling, believe that they're going to be scooped. They believe that they need to be very secretive about their ideas because obviously if someone hears about this, they're going to steal it. But what they don't realize is that actually happens a lot less than you would think, right? So I think maybe what you're doing, you know, security by obscurity is the right way to go because there's no real risk involved. And on the other hand, you're preparing your audience for what you're about to do next.
Exactly. And you can point to it. And it's not really security through obscurity, although I have quoted that phrase on my website. It's really trying my best to tell them what I'm thinking. I'm not really obscuring it at all, but I know that it's unlikely to take off. I tell my students, I say, rather than worrying about people taking your ideas, you should be worrying about people not taking your ideas.
Right, exactly.
Far more likely that you will come up with a great technology, you'll either publish it or have trouble publishing it or whatever, and it'll just never have an impact. I think that's the more serious problem. I've generally been a champion of open sourcing things, of even open source companies. You know, we had first completely open source sequencing device back in 2005. We told everybody how to make the reagents, how to make the device and so forth. We've had open source genomics where you have medical records of individuals that are public that required special consent and so forth. So yeah. Openness is your friend. It allows the whole world in principle to help you. Well, if you keep it a secret, you've just got yourself, which is pretty limited.
Openness is your friend. I like that. I also like your meme, we can call it, of embracing the outliers. You know, it reminds me, Daniel Segret, your former postdoc, now a professor at BU, he's an old friend of mine. And he once told me that the number one thing that he learned from you is to embrace the outliers.
Oh, yeah. I taught and teach occasionally computational biology courses and, you know, draw a plot, scatter plot. Well, there'll be one point that's way the heck off of the scatter plot, you know, the major.
Yeah, what's that?
And you could say, well, you could come up with a filter. You know, the filters are a really popular computational biology thing or
right.
Statistical tool. Or you could drill down on that point and figure out what's different.
Right.
It's either going to tell you something about your experimental methods that you should fix so you don't get artifacts, or is going to tell you there's something novel here in physics, chemistry, or biology, or both, that maybe before you fix it, you figure out what it is. And, you know, it could be anything. You know, there's often outliers, and we often ignore them. When I was doing crystallography, we had a case where there was a bond missing in the transfer RNA, but there's no bond there. And it turned out that the heavy atom that we use for solving the structure actually caused the RNA to cleave itself at that place. And so we had basically discovered RNA enzymes, ribozymes. We didn't publish on it. We didn't even think it was significant. It was just a broken bond that showed up in our electron density. And that similar thing happened to Tom Cech, is he's trying to make some RNA and it keeps getting spliced. It gets contaminated with some splice form. And that was, both of those were outliers and he paid attention to it. That was the difference.
Yeah, if you ignore the outlier, you might cheat yourself out of a discovery.
Exactly.
George, we've talked about a lot of aspects of the creative process in your lab and your own creative process. Is there something that we haven't talked about, but you think that would be interesting?
Oh, we could go on for hours. You know, it's becoming kind of a subject of study. There is a venture capital group called A16Z that has a social media article where the title was, "What's in the Water in the Church Lab?"
What are they drinking?
And as far as I know, it's not something in the water. But it does remind me of a movie where they changed the voting age downward. Wild in the Streets was called. And at some point they did put LSD in the water. But that's not what we're doing.
Good to know.
Yeah. Although it does seem like it sometimes. Great, George. Thank you so much for joining us on this.
My pleasure. This is a great service you're doing, I think. I'm now going to feel like I should listen to all of them.